And the whole idea of trying new stuff, it's so scary.
So, Werner, how do we start?
Hi, it's Werner and Egger, and this is the Catching the Next Wave podcast, where we discuss the future of design.
Ask is the CEO of a Danish consultancy Works, which is celebrating the 10th anniversary this year, which is pretty awesome. And what is Works? Works is a change agency, a company that helps other organizations to successfully go through the transformation process and through rebuilding the company culture. How do they do it? They seem to do it through empowerment, storytelling, and co-creation. Next to it, Ask is a master storyteller and an author of the book, The Third Generation of Storytelling, which got translated into English, but I don't think that it's available on the market just yet. And he's also a master of the Filipino martial arts. So like if you meet him in a dark alley, like don't throw a knife at him. Like, no, dangerous.
Not even in a dark alley when you meet any spice.
Ask, it's fantastic to have you here with us today.
Yeah, thank you very much for the invitation. Great to join you.
Congratulations on the anniversary. It must be pretty awesome to be in this place, right?
Yeah, and it's very nice. And also like looking back that we became an independent company just, you know, when the financial crisis started like 10 years ago.
Wow.
So it's been an interesting journey and it's been fun.
And Ask, maybe in a few short words, what is the thing that Works actually focuses on?
We started out as a little bit of a mixed child, you might say, with different kind of parents. So we had like one foot in the movie industry working. I worked as a script consultant, but also being inspired by dramatology and storytelling and so forth. And then me and my colleagues have always been very engaged in like game design, starting as a hobby, as kids, making role-playing games and board games and so on, but very much about how to use gamification and these different kind of tools to create involvement and so on. I've been working as a consultant for a little bit more than like 20 years. The fun part of that job is to visit all different kind of worlds. It's like going to the zoo every single day, visiting different organizations and try to find out what's up in the different kind of places. So that's been, you know, very interesting and fun throughout the years. In the beginning, we just really didn't know what we were doing, running on excitement and curiosity. And then slowly we're starting to become more like a real company, getting more and more professional in what we do. And for us, it's very much about like working with change that matters. So it's a combination of like sense making and make sure that the kind of ongoing journeys and organizations, and there's, I think, always a lot of like small journeys and big journeys going on at the same time in organizations, but how to help people navigate in this kind of mess and take ownership of the things that make sense. And then, of course, it's also about trying to make an impact, helping people in different kind of ways.
Just on that topic, right? I mean, this is something that we are thinking about is empowerment, right? So your company and your people focus on empowering and helping people in business, right? And so we're kind of working this premise that we are heading towards the end of the industrial era. And you must see a lot of people struggling with this aspect and managing their companies. Where's this whole thing moving towards?
It's a big question. I think that there's a lot of turmoil and changes going on right now. And I think we have to be very humble about our ability to really understand what goes on. And one of my academic inspirations, a very nerdy German sociologist called Niklas Luhmann, he said that mankind has never been able to either plan or predict what goes on in society. And in most cases, it's just many years later that we start to realize the kind of changes that happened decades ago. So I think that we're going to write some interesting books in like 20 or 30 years about what happens today. But now we really don't have a clue. What I experience is that we are slowly starting to realize that our ability to understand and navigate the world is getting very limited. There is so much complexity today in society, but especially also in organizations, that it's very hard to manage and lead in traditional ways. And that's the kind of realization and journey that most of our clients are struggling with. And now you talked about like empowerment. And I think that a key aspect is that it used to be the good old days, the old industrial kind of setups, that you needed your employees just to do what they were told to do. And that was like the role of management. Yeah. So that was like going down to a very simplified version, but going back to Taylor and the ideas about scientific management and so forth. Making sure that your workforce was compliant, did what they were told, and so on. What people are realizing now is that this is not enough. It's not enough that people do what they're told to do. People need to do what needs to be done. And there's a very big difference. And the management no longer have like the monopoly of knowing all the right kind of answers and solutions. So we have to delegate, we have to trust people, we have to trust that they can, you know, locally using their expertise, creativity, and so on, make the difference that matters. And hopefully as a manager, you have hired somebody that are better at their job than you are. So it's very much about delegation, but also realizing that the power and influence of management is very limited. So this is some of the discussions we have with our clients.
Because, I mean, management probably themselves are a little bit uncertain. So in a way, what you're doing is you're empowering people to manage uncertainty. Because the thing is, you can't plan forward anymore. It's like you said, you can't really see the future. You can't predict the future. So you need to kind of be able to navigate what's happening now to move towards the future.
I think in many cases, it's like the difference between if you perceive planning and so forth as handling like complicated questions, or if you see it as more like complex questions. And there's an important difference. One aspect is to say that if something is like complicated, it means that there is many elements at play, but they are consistent over time. It's like building a bridge. And the good thing about building bridges is that it's complicated, but the way that steel and water and concrete behaves, it's going to be consistent. So I can, in fact, you know, make a good bridge design. I can base it on best practice, the bridge we did 10 years ago. I can make a pretty good plan, and then I can execute as planned. And mankind are pretty good at executing these kind of projects. In most cases, when you make bridges, they go all the way and pretty much within timeline and budget. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that today, many of the most urgent and important challenges are not only complicated, they're also complex. And complex problems is problems where the key elements are inconsistent over time. They change. This is when humans are involved. So when you want to change the healthcare system or the political system, and if you want to make sure your employees are more customer-centric or more innovative and so forth, then we have to work with humans. And humans change all the time. And that means that we're not able to make the perfect plan to begin with. We can get inspiration from best practice, but we can't copy-paste blindly what we've done in the past. It will not work in the future. And in most cases, we have to go out and just and probe. And then we have to learn as we go along. And you can still create good results, but it's going to be more messy. And it's going to be more difficult to present to like a critical board of directors saying that, well, this was the plan. This is how we executed as planned. Now we have the results. And I think for many leaders, they really have to learn to be humble about, well, we have to go and probe. And it's not about being perfect, but it's about daring to do some stuff and then learning and adjust.
The whole thing with understanding complexity is that you have to understand that there is no a priori defined direction that you can follow. You can have an aspiration to follow a certain direction because you want to be in a certain place, but the way to the direction, to this place, can be 10 different options, and there's a randomness effect, which one of them will work and which one will not. How does the organization needs to change and adapt in order to be able to comprehend this whole model?
I think that for me, it very much comes down to culture. Culture is what defines like everyday behavior. It's sitting in the walls. Because what is important in real life is not what you do when the bus is looking or your mother-in-law is visiting. What is important is what you do when you're by yourself, not thinking about it. And this is also why in a lot of our work, we're very inspired by like behavioral design and economics. So it's really about how can you drive the right kind of behavior. And there, you know, culture is just a very, very important element. In the past, it was very important that you had like obedient, loyal employees. And many of the mechanisms in modern organizations, the tools for traditional leadership is very much about how to emphasize and strengthen this aspect about discipline and loyalty and so on. And that story also have a very a shadow side to it, which is about fear. Fear of, you know, being fired, fear of missing a promotion, and so forth. So this loyalty kind of based culture or fear-based culture was needed to a certain degree in the past to have people, you know, working consistently at the assembling lines. But what organizations need today is instead to have a culture that is based on trust. And trust is something very different from loyalty or discipline. First off, trust is about being a little bit naive. So a trust-based culture is based on hope. Because the essence of trust for me is it's about making yourself vulnerable. So let's say that I would admit something to you in this podcast that if you shared it with my colleagues or my wife, I would get in trouble. That's a way of sharing trust. Trust is about putting your faith in the hands of others. Sometimes I think about like this picture of, you have like these, when it all started out, you know, with civilization, like these two cavemen meeting each other, and both were standing with a club and being very afraid that the other one was like a cannibal, tried to eat them. And then at a certain point, one of the cavemen was just like, well, what the fuck, and put down the club. And this is where civilization started. And the reason why we need to vulnerability in organizations today and trust is that it's the most efficient way to not reduce, but to be able to handle high levels of complexity. And the good thing about trust is that enables us to delegate complexity in a very efficient way. So instead of me having to, in my company, have a say in everything and try to make decisions and have opinions about everything, there are certain elements where I can just trust my colleagues that they know better. So it's very much about like, stop having opinions and trust your colleagues to do it instead. One thing is to change the like the official organizational diagram, but really to have like the trust-based kind of culture that will lubricate and make these kind of new structures work. That's the tough part of the journey, because as a leader in a trust-based company, it's very different. It used to be like the good leader was the one with all the right answers, but now the good leader is the person willing to ask for help. I had an excellent leader in a big Danish company that I've been working with, and she had a great point where she said that, well, and normally as a leader, when you go home from work, when you felt that you had a good day, it was a day where you made a lot of decisions. Because I was like a good leader, and then I make decisions, and then it had to be black and white and that much money and yes and no and so forth. So like a good day as a leader, living up to the ideals of leadership was about making a lot of decisions. And she shared with me that slowly she started to realize that was not the way forward. That in most cases, she made decisions just more or less on autopilot. And because she made all the decisions, you know, all her colleagues got disempowered. So leadership is very much about not making the decisions. And it's about not trying to live up to this idea about having the right kind of priorities and solutions based on your gut feeling or making this very fast. So it's very much about being humble. It's about asking for help. It's about admitting when you're in doubt. And this is tough for many, many leaders. Yeah. Because this is not the kind of ideals that they've been navigating towards during their educations and upbringing and so on.
Mm-hmm. But what is the glue that brings the leader and the people working in the organization together? What is it?
I think, in fact, that trust just by itself can be magic. And if you have like these kind of anecdotes where you had like somebody coincidence saving another person's life, then you have a bond for life. It's very hard to untangle these kind of connections. So I think just trust in itself is like social magic. But you're right about big organizations. Of course, they need something to be together about. And I think there's like two elements. One is about, of course, like an outer purpose, some problem in the world that needs to be fixed. There is a call for adventure, a call for heroes, and we have to go and fight this fight together. But then also there is the power of collaboration, because we still have in the genes and in our instincts and so forth, this seeking to be part of a community. We like to be part of a tribe. We are social animals. So I think that's also a key driver. And one thing is about like external purpose, but in many cases, it's also just about being a group, doing stuff together. The joy of not being just ourselves, which is in many ways very boring and unfulfilling, but just doing stuff together with people. And I think that good organizations can do both. They have the sense of community and about creating a tribe in a good way, but it's a tribe about driving some change that is needed in the world.
Coming to one of the conversations that we had in the season one with Kelly Wood, Kelly said that what creates good community is that people lift each other up. And what I think in the traditional, like industrially driven organization often happens is that people are trying to pull everyone down so they can go up. So there is always this competition with the zero sum result. And what you're saying in this social trust tribal group, the clue is to get everybody going up together. So like, you know, like you help each other to reach the potential.
What is so strong about having the kind of group feeling and these kind of elements is that it's not about winning. And I think that's one of the problems that we have from, you know, industrial society, is this whole idea about we always have to go up and faster and better and richer and smarter and so on. And sometimes you just need to be. sometimes it's okay just to hang out and enjoy the good company. We don't have to, you know, what's the race?
My interpretation of this, what you're saying is what organizations need to do is to leverage things that have been existing for billions of years. The need for group, the need of belonging. It's sometimes very hard to quantify those things, right? Because I want to belong to a group of people because I like belonging there. It doesn't have to have this higher purpose. And what I'm hearing from you is that the larger organizations to kind of navigate some of these really complicated, complex things, maybe just need to look at the more simple, more human nature things of group. I started thinking about when you started talking about trust is that if I bring in this natural feeling of trust, and let's say I am in an organization and then all of a sudden that trust is broken, I think that could be quite serious. Is there a way that you can build that trust back up as a big organization?
Trust is very fragile and it takes a long time to build and you can destroy it very, very quickly.
Exactly.
I think one of the big problems about professional life today and organizations and so on is that we have so high expectations. And in big organizations, you know, you have to be high performing, you have to be very professional. And in most cases within organizations, because people are good at what they do and very professional, we're like standing to our necks in professionalism and mastering what we do. And the problem is that when we are asked to do something new, then by definition, we're not as good as we normally are. We suck when we try something out for the first time. And for most people in modern organizations that is used to being good at what they do, they used to live up to very high expectations. The whole idea of trying new stuff, probing stuff out, prototyping and so on, it's so scary. It's so hard for them. Mm. And that's why trust is needed, because we have to trust that our colleagues will not make fun of us. We'll have to trust ourselves that, well, I haven't tried it before, but let's see how it goes. So I think that trust is a strong catalyst in these kind of processes, which is very hard. And one of the reasons why we like to use some kind of game-based tools in certain situations is that it's a way of taking away some of the pressure from people. And there is so much fear and pressure in modern organizations. And the idea about playing is to say that, well, you know, now we're just trying it out. We're not working with real clients and budget and so on. It's just the game pieces and monopoly money. So we allowed, without the pressure, to take some perhaps small but important steps in your direction. And then we can make some learningful mistakes, and it's okay. In many cases, people like to use, like, you know, points and competitions and leaderboards and so forth, really to drive engagement. And for me, that's the exact opposite of what is needed in most cases. When we work with our tools, it's the main focus is to put trust into the process and really to have people be curious, be open, to explore and so forth. So in most of our game-based solutions, we have perhaps a little bit of a competitive element, but it's very secondary to everything else.
It's kind of you giving people a space to be vulnerable.
Exactly.
Because I see sometimes when beautiful communities are created or people start interacting on a real basis, there's of course the trust. But before the trust happens, you need to be vulnerable. It's like your caveman story. Someone had to drop his club.
Yeah, exactly.
Can you tell a little bit more about how you think of the games and how you design them and what is the role of games and playfulness in these processes?
This is my favorite subject in the world.
So we'll sit back.
All right.
No, I think what is so amazing about playful learning and games is that it's nothing new. So when you look at like small animals, but also our kids, playing is how they take in the world. It's how they learn how to navigate and build skills. So the playfulness is in our genes. And if you look at also at human civilization, you know, the first games about leadership and life and strategy were designed many years before the first books were written on the same subjects. The oldest games, like the King Game of Ur from Mesopotamia, when they were like opening the tomb of Tutankhamun, there were a board game inside. So since like the beginning of a civilization, we have been using games and play to support, you know, training, understanding life, different kind of expectations, goals, and so on. And this goes across different kind of cultures, you know, from ancient China to the Kriegsspiel of the Prussian armies. And so when we work with game design and game-based learning, it's not about bringing something new to the table, but it's in fact to go back to some of the roots. We have the pleasure of working with companies throughout the world. I just spent like a week in Shanghai working with Chinese leaders. And what is so amazing is that this joy of involvement, playfulness, it transcends all differences regarding cultures and industries and so on. Everybody likes it. Everybody enjoys it. It's just a part of our DNA. So for us, it's very much also to be like, going also back to what we talk about with complexity, that the most important part of life, but also when it comes to like collaboration and leadership and so on, you have to find your own solutions. You can't just copy paste what your father did or how you were taught in school. You have to find out how to own it and how to master it in your own way. And this you can only do by exploring. Many of our processes is finding like a safe, structured way to like get people playing, get them engaged, and then help them to make their own conclusions. And the point is that, and there's a double point, because one thing is their personal solutions is what is best for them. So it's not about they have to copy paste, and find my solution. They have to make, find their own way. But also it's so important that they have ownership of the solution, because we have to have both. And the way we see these kind of tools is a way of like designing like meaningful conversations. And this is also why that we have a preference for like physical tools. We do some digital games and solutions, but most of our tools are physical. It's like, board game, card games. And we see these gaming elements as like talking pieces. I think that in the world today, we spend so much time looking at screens, and screens are great for a lot of stuff. But when we bring people together, we have to look at each other. When you play some of our games, you might learn something from the game, but mainly you learn from each other. You might even say some of these games is like an artificial like campfires.
Yeah.
That will help to involve people and structure like a shared storytelling where they can share, insights, best practice. And during the process, they're going to learn from each other. And also in certain ways, they're going to learn new stuff from themselves. Because I think like a well-designed game is also a way of helping you to realize some of the tacit knowledge that you might not be aware about in most cases.
I love the aspect of artificial campfire, because It brings me to another question I wanted to ask you, is that in my culture, we go out in the bush and we sit around this real campfire and we tell stories. And I know something else that you're very passionate about is narrative and storytelling. How does the whole idea of storytelling then fold into this whole aspect of empowering people and changing organizations?
I think in a certain way, it's like one of them the same. And what is interesting also that now neuroscience is getting so advanced that now science is also backing it up. We are designed to be storytelling creatures. This is the way our mind is designed. So you might say that the only way that we can perceive and comprehend the world is by forming it into stories. So reality is so complex that we can't take it all in. And the only way we're able to navigate this complexity is to use storytelling to reduce stuff. So it's a way of coping and making meaning of life. Basically, it's about helping people to understand like the core questions of life. What's the meaning of all this stuff? Who am I? What's my role, my expectation? And to answer these kind of questions, we tell stories about ourselves. And I know this is a little bit old theory, but there's this psychologist, Mead, who he had like this way of describing consciousness as a conversation in the mind between I and me. And I think it might be a little bit more complicated than that. But we all the time have like a story about the world and ourselves in the world that we retell ourselves, we reproduce every single moment in our lives. So storytelling is very important. And of course, storytelling, sometimes we know that it is a story. But for me, I think a key insight is that even the stories we don't think are stories are still stories. And we might have this idea that there is something that's like objective, but it's never. Even the whole story about objectivity is a story as well. So we are storytelling creatures, and we try both as individuals, but also as organizations and society to make sense of a very complicated world, and we use stories to do it. And so there's a lot of power in stories. And this is also what I try to address in my book, that we have to take ownership of the stories. And we really have to, instead of just being a passive audience, just following the stories of generals and kings and priests and marketeers, we have to take ownership and create our own stories. And because this is where the power is, but this is also where the joy of life is.
And I think your book has become even more relevant these days, because it feels like we kind of, there's this little bit of a regression to listen to other people's stories. We need to start focusing on our own stories.
I think one of the beginning parts of my book is I write about this very special moment a few years ago where my oldest son, Storm, and he's 9 now, but he was like 5 or 6 back then. And one day he asked me if it was okay to believe both in Jesus and Thor from Norse mythology.
I remember.
And I was like, sure, you know, go ahead. And then it really struck me that just to be able to ask this kind of question was amazing. Because going back only a few generations, it would be like unthinkable, consider it. Because we would never have a choice. We would be like brainwashed into a certain belief system and so on from our parents and the authorities. So we have today amazing freedom in most of the world to pick our own narratives, our own beliefs. And one of the big shifts I see in the world today is that people really slowly start to realize and embrace this freedom in a good way. And first, we just used our freedom to choose between the stories that were offered to us by others. So it was like the freedom of the shopper. Okay, you can go to the supermarket. It's like a buffet of different identities, and then you can make your choices. But of course, that's a limited freedom because somebody else has designed the choices for you to choose from. And today, I think people are slowly like really starting to own the role of storytellers themselves and realizing that what really makes sense, where you really have a purpose, is the kind of stories we create together with others. And it's stories about not only like hanging out or having nice, you know, fashion choices and so on and being on Instagram, but it's the stories about change. It's about going out, doing something that is not only for ourselves, but also for others. And I think in these times, looking at politics and Trump and climate change, it's very easy to be very depressed. But when I see the engagement in young people throughout the world and how they really like, you know, embrace freedom and take ownership, I think there's also room for a little bit of optimism.
There's one thing you said, Ask, is that at the end you were talking about the story of me, but when I listen to you now, you also spoke about co-creation of stories. Do you think that the co-creation of stories at the end is probably going to move things forward more in a positive way? Because I, at some stage, I felt like the idea of just the story of me becomes a very selfish idea. Whilst it is empowering, if you look at the past, but then moving forward, it actually needs to become the co-creation of stories together with other people.
Storytelling is always a process, and it's always a relationship because a story is nothing in itself. It is like you're not a storyteller if you go out in the woods and just start screaming by yourself alone.
Yeah.
You have to have an audience, or you have to be schizophrenic. But it's a social process. So even if you focus on like the story of me, well, you do it in interaction with others. Then, and this is like a kind of dynamics I think are very interesting in how we do it together in different kind of communities. And this is also what we try with the projects and the organizations we try to work with, that it used to be like the good like change communications was about having this strong narrative from top management about a burning platform and a compelling vision. And then you just have to like force feed the rest of the organization with this kind of strong story. And then everything would be great and people had a purpose. And from my experience, it's not that easy. So it's much more about how you can include people. And including people, it's going to be a little bit more messy. And top management will feel that they're like losing power. But this is where they have to start trusting people. And then we're going to can create something like beautiful shared stories.
Traditional management, like you said, has trouble trusting people. What does traditional management can do to teach themselves to trust people?
That's a good question. I think that from my experience, it's hard to change. And even though we might like to do it, for most of us, when we reach a certain age, we're going to get pretty stuck in our habits. And of course, we can learn new stuff and get smarter, but it's a slow process. So for me, it's not so much about asking people just to like transform themselves and going into therapy. I think it starts with being a little bit humble. Just start by realizing that there is other perspectives. The kind of road you have followed in the past might not be the right one going forward. And then instead of trying to, okay, then I have to find the right road or the right solution by myself, then it's about starting asking for help. For me, it's not so much about learning new ways of doing stuff, but it's much more about starting just to realize that there are other perspectives and that I can't just follow the autopilot. But that is tough.
Mm. Can you see the differences between the different regions in the world or different countries in this respect?
This is something that is really fascinating me. And we recently did a game called Bridge Builders, which is about how to lead global teams with different kind of cultures and across distance.
You won some award with this game, right?
Yeah. And it was so funny to do the research and both like looking at the science on the topics, but also talking with a lot of different kind of companies. I think one thing that struck me was that, of course, there is some very important and strong cultural differences between different countries. But I think we have to really go away from the idea that everybody from Germany are the same or everybody from India are the same and so on. And I think there's a lot of cultural diversity within, you know, every single country, but also within every single company. But that being said, there are some important differences. And many of these are very subtle. So at a glance, we don't notice. But when you really start to take a closer look, they play a very important role in organizational life today. And I can highly recommend a book called The Culture Map by Erin Meyer, which is very nice and cover this. And I had a lot of insights from reading the book and really realized a lot of mistakes that I made in the past. And I think that for me, one of the main cultural differences is one thing is very much like the importance of the individual versus the group. That we have a tendency in like Northern Europe, especially like I think in Denmark, but also in like Holland and some other countries, where it's okay to, as an individual, to criticize your colleagues or management. And even it's praised to be like, you know, the individual like standing out. And there are some cultures where this isn't working out. And it's even in the way you have the language, you know, culture is very rooted in language. And some organizations in some countries, they simply lack like the language to have this individual versus group kind of dialogues. And coming from Denmark, where we are, you know, compared to other countries, we're like very blunt in our communications. We like to be sarcastic and so forth. We can very fast make a fool of ourselves and be very insensitive. So some kind of these dynamics. Now we talked earlier about like traditional roles of leadership and industrial organizations. And I think that many of those organizations were based on like an American or Anglo-Saxon approach to leadership. And our ideals about what is a good leader is coming from this kind of tradition and where you cherish the, you know, the individual talent and so forth. And I'm starting to wonder if that the next generation of successful companies, I think many of these companies probably will come with a cultural background more from Asia. That they're more sensitive to relationships. They're more sensitive to the community. I think they might be better equipped for like co-creation and so on. But it's going to be interesting to see.
From the model of Gerard Hofstede, I remember that the Asian cultures are much more long-term thinkers. In the Anglo-Saxon culture, you strive for quick success. Like you mentioned before, you've got this 20% growth each year, quarterly bonuses, stuff like that. In Asian cultures, the goal is much longer term. If there is a president of a company, he's not changing the company so he can have a success, but he's following a line of philosophical approach to the business that was created by his predecessors, and he has to be in line with that. Otherwise, the continuity is lost, which is a completely different model than the model that we have in Western world.
There's not one Asia, there's many Asias.
Of course.
But I think what we mentioned, I think it's very clear in countries like Japan, for instance, but also to a certain degree in China. And I think they are in for some very interesting changes always like happening right now. Because they had like an older generation that was like very hardworking, very much like relationship oriented, very much about like coming from a communist background. And there's a big clinch between the traditional ways of working in China. And then we have like all these new talents coming out, being brought up during, you know, blooming economy and being single children. And they're used to being much more individual, much more critical, perhaps even a little bit spoiled. So there's a big clash in Chinese organizations about how to make these two different kind of cultures merge and work out. And I think that's going to be very interesting to see how it goes.
Very, very interesting. Yeah. I'm interested to see how that's going to play out.
Yeah. So, okay, we are talking about culture. How do you define culture? What is culture for you?
I think one approach to working with culture is to look at behavioral design. And in behavioral design, there's like one of the most famous model is to talk about like system one and system two, slow thinking and fast thinking from Kahneman. And for me, culture is about the fast thinking. It's like running an autopilot. So it's the kind of basic structures that are so much wired into our brain, or we even talk about them being wired into our spine, that this is what we do when we're not thinking about it. And for me, culture is what defines how we react and perceive things when we're not conscious about it. sometimes we're able to activate our system two, our slow thinking, to be analytic. And in these situations, which are very energy consuming and tough for us to do, well, then we can, to a certain degree, you know, reflect our own culture and we can have some other perspectives. But very fast, we fall back to our autopilots. We just do what we normally do. And do this because this is the way our body has been designed. Our bodies come with the integrated optimization consultants. So the body will always adapt on a physical level to what we do the most. So if I do a lot of push-ups, then our triceps are going to get strong. And if I do a lot of pull-ups, then my biceps are going to get strong. So my muscles are going to grow and change depending on what I do to make it easier for me to do the same things in the future. And the mind works exactly the same way, meaning that the neurons in our brains is always growing and changing, making it easier for us to tell the stories that we tell the most. And I think this is how culture is getting, you know, into the physical world. Because when we like part of a culture and a culture defined what is acceptable, normal, and so forth, it guides our behavior in many ways and how we perceive the world. It's a way of like reducing complexity. And our culture is embedded on a physical level in our mind, into the kind of framings, the metaphors that we use to navigate. So for me, it's like something very physical. And it's something that's very hard to change. And this is why, you know, even today, it's still very hard to do something about like essential cultural problems on racism, on sexism, and so forth, because it's very deeply rooted in us.
Absolutely. So as a person who is running a company that talks about change and cultural change, what would you recommend as the first step that people should take or could take in order to initiate a process of culture change?
So one thing to start with is to slow down. In many cases in modern organizations, you have this idea about that the world is going so fast, we are missing out, competitors are running away from us. And I think that this can be a trap. So I think one thing is just to, you know, to slow down and start thinking. And I think one of the problems, especially for leaders, is that in most cases, when we go out and listen, we don't really listen. We listen to answer. So a starting point is just give yourself the freedom and time to go out and listen, only to understand. Don't try to just, you know, have the right answer ready, but instead just go out and explore a little bit to understand with your customers and do it with your colleagues. It's a small step, but I think that can make a lot of difference. And I think you're going to learn a lot very fast. And the good thing is that when we meet as humans on a respectful, trustful way, then magic happens by itself because we are designed to connect when we meet face to face. We are designed to, you know, scientists are talking about our mirror neurons in our brains, that we synchronize when we look eye to eye and start talking to each other and listening to each other. So I think the first part is to start spending time together, you know, put down the phones, put down the slide decks, just start to listen and talk to each other. Many, many consultants make a very good living by analyzing the world. And they are hired to go to companies and then tell them about what their problems are. But from my experience, that in many, many cases, the people in the company already know the most important problems. They already know. And I think that sometimes instead of hiring a lot of consultants, if they just shut the door, turned off the screens, put down the phones and just start to talk about what goes on, I think they could very fast agree about the top five things we could do better in any organization and then start doing something about it.
I love the advice that you gave. Yeah. But I can imagine all the top managers that I know going and saying, yeah, sure, this is all good, but we have to innovate. So how does innovation fit into all of this?
Okay, one approach to it, and this is a little bit of a segue, but then we can get back to innovation later on. But just a story I like to, or insight I like to share, is that when I started to study at university many years ago in the 90s, and I studied like political science and some sociology, and there was I was introduced to this decision-making model called the garbage can model by Marx and Olson. To put it very easily, this model says that, well, we have this idea about what's the rational way of making decisions in organizations. So that we have a problem, then we look at different kind of solutions, then we make a decision, then we go and execute the decision. So there's like a sequence. And what these scientists realized by looking at a lot of cases is that in real life, that is not always the case. that sometimes you start by having the solutions and then you look for the problem and then you make the decisions or vice versa. And they describe what's called like the garbage can model, that in big organizations, they have problems circling around. They have solutions circling around. They have decision-making opportunities circling around. And then sometimes, more or less by coincidence, they end up in like the same kind of a garbage can or decision window, and then stuff happens. And it's more or less arbitrary and random what kind of solution is mixed with what kind of decision and what kind of problem. And I remember the university, when I was introduced to this theory, I wouldn't believe it. I was like, no. In real life, the professional people, this cannot be the case. But then later on, you know, I got into reality and been working as a consultant for 20 years. I think this model is spot on in many, many places.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a lot of irrationality or randomness in big organizations. But the problem is that it's very hard for us to accept that stuff is so random. So even though we might have a very irrational decision-making process, where we started by making a decision, I'm a new boss, I have to do something, I have 100 days. And then we made a more or less random match of a problem with a solution. Then in hindsight, we have to make it look good. So there's a lot of like internal storytelling going on, making sure that in hindsight, everything looks very rational, professional.
And planned.
Exactly. And I think this is needed to a certain degree. But also, I think sometimes we spend way too much time on making it like look good in hindsight, instead of just being a little bit more realistic and upfront about, well, stuff happens and then let's go and make the best of it. I try to really read many books and get inspiration on leadership and change. But I come back to this garbage can model again and again, even though it's old stuff, because I think it's very spot on what goes on. And linking it to innovation. Today, all organizations are screaming about, especially like digital innovation. And of course, it's important, it's relevant, but I keep thinking about these kind of flows. For me, I see many organizations as they have a need for making a decision about being more digital. There is expectations from the market, investors, the board about, okay, we have to have a digital strategy. So first they make the decision, and then they start to look for a solution. And today the solution, that's about, you know, machine learning and AI and robotics and so forth. So they don't really know what the solution is. The problem is they are missing the need. So we have organizations that have made the decision. They know what the solution is, but they don't have the problem. And then they're spending a lot of time to pick their hammer and start looking for nails. Today we see, of course, a lot of good and interesting stuff, but also we see some crazy investments in companies being very hectic about investing just in something digital, not because it makes a difference for the customers, but just because we need to catch this wave. And I know from the people I work with, you know, innovation functions and big companies, that it's tough for them to navigate these kind of parts. And there's like this huge pressure about for them to come up with something fantastic very fast. And good innovation takes time. And I think one of the key insights from also working with like design thinking and so on, it takes a long time to find out what really is the need, what really is the problem.
If I listen to what you're saying, I mean, I still have contact with managers who have this problem that there's the need for the quick fix. What is your advice to these guys?
Earlier this year, we host like a big conference in Copenhagen called like a Day of Play, which is like a yearly event that we have. And we had one of the presenters was this excellent CEO of, her name is Marianne, and she's like heading Microsoft in Denmark and parts of Scandinavia. And she shared this great story. She said that, well, she used to also work as a consultant. And she said that she worked in so many organizations where they had like always like a three-step strategy. So first step was about fixing the basics. And then step two was about growth. And then step three was about innovation. And at this conference, she shared that every single time they never came to step two or rarely came to step two and never to step three. As far as I remember it, she realized that you can't put it into a sequence. In organizations today, you have to do all three at the same time.
Yeah.
So you have to make sure that the basics are right. And that's like an ongoing responsibility and focus. Then, of course, you have to look at growth and getting the business running and so on. But then you also have to work on innovation at the same time. So I think that for managers today, as you mentioned, I think it's not about either or. They have to make a lot of compromises, finding out what is realistic, where I'm right now. Yeah, they have to do both. And it's not optimal, but this is just the way it is.
The only thing that I find a challenge these days is that I think that leadership do understand that it needs to happen in parallel, but the focus is probably happening not so much on the basics, but on the center one that is about running the business. So the core focus is about we need to make our short-term numbers, and then the basics kind of fall off the map. Innovation will happen in magic time.
I'm reminded of, if you know this old model, I think the anecdote is that it was like invented by Eisenhower for planning the invasion in Normandy. But so like this decision-making model about from looking at, is it urgent and is it important? So when you prioritize your tasks and so on, you ask the question of, is this important? Yes or no. Is it urgent? Yes or no. And that's give you like a nice matrix with like four different kind of options. And the problem in organizations and leadership always that there is a lot of stuff going on that is urgent, but not important. And this will fill out Outlook schedule very fast. And what is killing the organization is the stuff that is important, but not urgent. And this is like innovation and spending time with your kids and family and all these kind of essential parts, but you can always, you know, skip them one day more. And I think that can be one way of trying to understand the trap of leaders today. There is really a need for them to focus on what is important long-term, but there is also so much urgent stuff going on. And it's very hard to do both. And I think going back to like very traditional approaches on time management, it all comes down to planning. Because if you only try to make your decisions and prioritize ad hoc as you go along, then you're always going to prioritize the urgent parts. We have to use certain kind of tricks to make sure that we also prioritize the important parts that are not urgent. And this is about like scheduling time. It's about planning. It's about like we need a little bit of special kind of management and nudging to be able to get around to these things. And that's very tough.
This is going to be a weird question to ask, but let's say I am a manager and I get to work with you on and off. And I sit and reflect at my fireplace in the evening and I'm with my cognac in my hand. How do I know that I'm actually moving in the right direction?
Well, I think that if you're sitting by a fireplace with a cognac, then you're on the right direction, you know. If you're sitting late at night at the office looking into your laptop, then you might have a problem.
I love that.
I'm just reminded of one element. I think it's also part of the final chapter in my book, which is from the summarize of Japan. I've been very like fascinated by Japanese culture, and not so much like the real culture, but probably just the version that I saw in samurai movies as a kid. Yeah. But I think the whole idea about the Bushido and the kind of mentality and philosophy of the Japanese warrior is fascinating. And as I've understood it, the whole idea is very much about accepting your faith. And the key point is that if you start to look at like the long-term perspectives, then the outlook for any samurai, you know, back in the days were very dire because, you know, you could be killed on the battlefield tomorrow. If your lord got upset and committed suicide, you were expected to do the same and so on. So if you started to think long-term about your future, you would have an instant depression. So the whole philosophy of the Bushido was to just be very casual about like the long-term perspective, about the big question. Do I die today or tomorrow? Who cares? We're all going to die. And these kind of big decisions, you know, make them on a whim. Just, well, whatever, I do this. So don't think about like these like long-term serious stuff. But then instead focus on what is happening right now, because it's very hard to sometimes to make the big decisions and know what is right. But if you look at our immediate situation, this is something where we can control. So the Bushidos were very much focused on how to be very, very good and precise and excellent at the small things, like how to make your tea or how to draw your sword and so on. And I think for me, that's an interesting inspiration or guideline for life, because if you start to think about all the big stuff all the time, you're just going to get confused and stressed and depressed. So I recommend that instead of focusing on all the small things, but all the big decisions, well, who knows, you know, the future will tell. But instead, focus on the immediate people around you, the things that you enjoy, the good cognac, your family, friends. And this part of the world, we can control. And there we have a real impact. We can make a difference for ourselves and for people that we care about. So it's very much about focusing short-term on your immediate surroundings. And then I think there is, of course, a little bit of interconnection between the short-term and the long-term. So even if you don't think about how it's going to be in the future and the long-term aspects, that if you focus and make the right kind of decisions short-term, well, there's going to be some spillover effect, some good karma helping you also to go nice places long-term. So I think that coming back to good advice to managers, I think it's also just to be realistic and focus on what you can do right now and just have some pride in delivering, you know, on the small things, being good to your colleagues and helping stuff out and so on. Don't think so much about disruption and long-term stuff and how Amazon is going to take over everything. You know, who knows? Who cares? We can't,
yeah, you can't
make a big
that.
Difference. Exactly. So focus short-term, do your best, enjoy it as you go along. And then hopefully being good at the short-term stuff will also help you to get the best of the future.
I dig it. I think it's somewhere I read something, or probably one of these people who tell you how to live your life. It's like, don't sweat the small stuff. And I think ask what I'm hearing from you is sweat the small stuff. And the longer term stuff will kind of take care of itself as long as you're moving in the right direction. I like that.
The long term stuff is made out of these small decisions that you are sweating over, right?
What I was also just reminded that, and I think that this, and it's very banal advice or just some fundamentals, but I think it's very much the core of human life. And I'm really a big fan of the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is, as far as I know, like the first story ever, you know, recorded and written down. And in fact, in this book, this story, the main character is asking about what is the essence of life. And the answer in that book, and this is like, you know, I think more than 10,000 years back. And the answer is like, well, you know, drink nice, have a good time with your family, enjoy your kid and wife. And it's just the very fundamentals of everyday life.
So where does the design as a field fit into all of this innovation, change, decision taking?
Yeah. Because we've spoken about a few things now. We've spoken about empowerment of employees, transformation organizations, sweating the small stuff. What is the role of design in all this?
For me, design, there are two perspectives. I think one is a way of perceiving the world. And I think from that point of view, I think, you know, design thinking and so forth can be a good inspiration. But it's also about a practice to think about that when you work with leadership or change and so on, to think about, well, we are designing a new culture. We are designing new processes or new kind of behaviors. So for me, I like the doing part of the design approaches, and the creative part, I think, is very important. What I don't like about the design approaches is that in some cases, it can be very naive. And you have this idea that you can come, like, you know, as these magicians from outside, and then you can do observations, and then you put a lot of post-its and pictures on a wall, and then you see these magic patterns, and then you find this awesome solution, and you make an app, and then, you know, hooray. And I think that design has to be combined with a lot of humbleness and understand that the real solutions are not that easy in most cases. And this is also why I very strongly like co-creation, that you have to create it together with people. Also because that for me, it's so important that the right solution, it's not about the best design solutions, but in many cases, it's about the solution that has the strongest, broadest ownership. And I think that sometimes design processes is about, well, you have this great solution and you think that it has a value in itself. But from my experience, that you can have the best of solutions, but if it has no parents, it really doesn't matter. It's dead on arrival.
So don't you think that in a way design thinking as the process became a little bit industrialized, meaning that suddenly it became this golden recipe that if you throw something at the beginning, something good should come at the end, which is not true. We all know it. And then people sort of imagine that by the sheer act of doing the moves, like, you know, just dancing, you'll get something great. And they are deeply disappointed when it doesn't happen.
Getting back to like the garbage can model and so on, I think that in many cases, when companies were, they had to make a decision, but they really didn't have any clue about what was the problem or the solution. Then they would call on design thinking. It's like, well, we need to do some stuff. And it has to be like a human-centered. And you can look at it nicely and say, well, then they explore and make skunk works, and that's bold and very nice. But I think in many cases, it's a way of not owning the problems themselves, because I'm sure there's a lot of real problems in all these organizations. So it's also like a band-aid. It's like a quick fix.
Mm.
And when it's not rooted and grounded in the organization, then the impact long-term is going to be very limited. And I think the experience from a lot of design thinking processes is that it's great fun. You might come out with some good insights and a few good solutions, but it's so hard to get them implemented large-scale in organizations. And it's so hard to anchor it afterwards. And in many cases, when you come back a few years later, there isn't like a single trace of these kind of insights and solutions long-term.
How do you see potential role of design in changing the company culture? What's the potential there?
I think the whole field of design, to a certain degree, will like merge with the disciplines of leadership development and innovation and other disciplines. And I think it's a good thing. And of course, sometimes it's nice to keep it separated. It's nice and clean and you can write books and you can study it and so on. But reality is messy. So I think also like the going forward, I think that both the practice and the way of doing it, it would really have to be much more like cross-disciplinary regarding these kind of elements. And I think management thinking can really learn a lot from design thinking. I think that both management thinking and design thinking can learn a lot from like behavioral design and behavioral insights. So I think these kind of disciplines, if you like boil them all together, it's going to be very, very interesting.
So ask, what is the next wave for organizations?
I think the one thing that I think is going to be interesting is that I think we're going to see people going back to a certain degree and longing for like old school management and old school organizations. And I think there's going to be like a counter reaction, because right now some organizations are considering to be like, well, have to be, everything has to be deorganized, very flat holacracy and so forth, still organizing teams and everything has to be digital and we don't have an office space any longer and it's all virtual teams. So there is a lot of these kind of trends and tendencies. And I think some of them are going to be interesting and a few successful. But I think that also we're going to see a counter wave. So we're also going to see people be like, no fucking way. Let's have one place. Let's meet one team where we can share lunch. Let's have, instead of having everybody discussing all the stuff all the time, let's have a manager who makes some decisions and some directions. So I think we're going to have a mix of going very new directions and trying stuff out. And then also we will learn to treasure the good parts of the old traditions.
Yeah.
And I think it's, and now we start to talk about the end of the industrial era and the traditional ways of leading and managing. And I think, of course, we have to be very critical, but also there is a lot of good stuff in the past. And I think that we have also to perhaps to rediscover some of these old insights. And when me and my colleagues look for inspiration, well, sometimes we try to look ahead at some of the newest trends, but as much we also look in the past, finding inspiration from like the old Prussian armies and Clausewitz and so forth. So I think it's going to be a good mix. But I think we're going to see a lot of like old school organizations again.
And then ask, do you have a specific book recommendation for us? If there's one book that you can recommend to our listeners, what would that be?
I think one book I can, if you're into leadership, I can highly recommend the book called Art of Action by a guy called Stephen Bungay. And he's an English author and military historian. And he also been working as a consultant. And this is just a very nice book about like traditional military leadership, good insights from the Prussian army about Aufstandstaktik. I think that's an excellent leadership book that I can highly recommend it.
Thank you.
Ask, if you were to say what your personal motto for the world is, what would it be? The motto that gets you out of bed every day?
Well, the little bit banal, like professional answer is about working with change that matters. I think I'd really enjoy to see an impact of what I do. And I think that's also what drives people today. So go out and make some changes that matters. So that's the one part. I was reminded by, do you know this comic book called Calvin and Hobbes?
Yeah.
which is just, it's just awesome. It's about a small boy and his imaginary friend who's a tiger. And he has this saying that without sin, no redemption. So the point is that you have to go out and do stuff. And you can't start with redemption. No, you have to go out, make some mistakes, fuck things up. Then you can learn. And I think that's also good advice in life, you know. So it's also about, well, go out, enjoy life. Don't try to be perfect from the beginning. And then we're going to learn.
Thank you so very much for being with us today. It was extremely insightful and my mind is just boiling. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Catching the Next Wave podcast. We really appreciate it. Even better, we would love to connect with you. You can reach us on Twitter at Marcus6 and at WienerDog. And for more information, you can always go to www.catchingthenextwavepodcast.com. We'd love to hear from you.
Slow down and start thinking.